your plans were secret when you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all.
This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker. Tom Esker. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
This is the webmaster on 12/27/2016. I asked to do this show today. I wanted to bring a couple of things to your attention. One is an ex-retired CIA agent who is being questioned by a financial expert with some very interesting answers. Also, along with this, there is a doctor who's given extensive lectures regarding the importance of water. Water for the body, water towards water's influence on society, and the importance of it for the future of a society at all. And along that lines, I want to remind everyone that all these shows and the many more shows that we have from the past that haven't even been heard yet require time, energy, and money for the equipment and the importance of keeping individual websites up for the freedom of speech that we are quickly losing through social media. There are many social media outlets that have banned any controversial speech by shutting down the individual's accounts. So this radio club is very important to the maintenance of keeping the radio shows, the website, and all the information that needs to be put out there. Now, I know there are others out there that could be made aware that this radio show is available with vital information. The word just needs to be passed around, and I'd ask that all of you out there in the radio club, please do so. And it does not have to be people who you know. All it requires is sending them the link to the radio club on our website at resist.com. That link is in your radio club email that you get daily and can be put out there in many various ways, spread far and wide. So please assist us with that, because we really love what we do, but to be able to do it does come at some expense.
Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Ed Z, retired counterintelligence officer. Ed, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Max.
All righty. Ed, you were an agent for decades, trained during the first Cold War and working up through the War on Terror. What keeps you up at night? What's the biggest threat to the people of America right now?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, terrorism is on everyone's mind. We've gone into a new era of terrorism. I never really worked in a terrorism arena too much, but obviously, lone wolf's attacks are the biggest issue as we face now. But I guess what keeps me awake at night is actually the cyber threat we're facing from our foreign adversaries. We've been kind of touching on a little bit recently with the Russian hacks, but the hacking and the level of sophistication that's been happening over the last, especially 5 years, has been
incredible. Let's talk about cyber attacks for a second.
Sure.
Like, what could happen in a cyber attack? What could happen?
Sure. I think, you know, and this is kind of my own personal view of the next 15 years, 5, 10, 15 years, essentially, is an attack on our financial system. Right now, a lot of people don't carry a lot of cash. We use credit. We have financial institutions that have a lot of our money in numerical on paper form. But there's only a few nodes out there that really encapsulate all of the things we have in our financial arena. And if anything, there was an attack on that, I think that's going to be cause major havoc in the future. I think that's where it's going to be.
Now, interestingly, at the current time, a lot of countries are engaged in what some call the war on cash. We see in India, for example, they've re-monetized their entire system. Countries are getting rid of cash. More and more, you can only use plastic or use electronic payment systems. So the safety that would come with having cash in the hand is being eliminated at the same time. Is that a risk, or is that planned, or what's that all about?
You know, I really don't have too much in-depth knowledge of that. That's not really my background. I think the issue is the security of our financial institutions and the protection of not having all of our eggs in one basket, in other words. From what I understand, a lot of our transactions throughout the country, whether it's credit, whether it's financial transactions, are all done through only a few locations. I think that needs...
What about that previously heralded economic espionage from China? Is that still a thing? In other words, you know, we're hearing a lot about Russia these days. Before this, it was China, China, China. Is that still a threat?
Sure. And I think we may have touched on this before when we met. Essentially, after 9/11, all the money that was really funneled towards what counterintelligence and intelligence systems were doing and agents were doing was actually redirected towards terrorism, which left the Chinese and the Russians real. We were left vulnerable to them. The Chinese espionage has never stopped. It's actually incrementally gone up exponentially every year. And you're going to see more and more of it now that we've kind of still continued to focus on terrorism and lone wolf attacks and terrorism in general. Espionage and the stealing of our information and stealing defense secrets and stealing of technology and our intellectual property is at an all-time high. And it's because we're not really focused on it and the American public is not really focused on it. But it occurs every day.
All right, let's, I guess, touch on Russia and what's going on. And there's so much almost hysteria out there right now. The whole popular culture in America seems to be focused on this perceived Russian threat. You have the Hillary Clinton blaming Russian hackers for her loss. And it really has become an obsession. From your experience now, you've retired now, but you were in the intelligence business for many, many years. Can you put that into context for us? Where are we in all this? Is it hyped, overhyped, or is it real, or what are your thoughts?
I don't think it's overhyped at all. We really have to be concerned with it. The foreign intelligence services from foreign governments, the foreign adversaries that we have, really everyone is our enemy, is the way I looked at life when I was working.
There are five countries that we consider to be kind of all on the same page, right? What are those five? It's U.S., I think Canada.
Australia, New Zealand, oh, really? And of course, Great Britain.
Okay.
The others don't get as much information as far as top secret and intelligence sharing, intelligence gathering information, and the products that we use. Really, those are the top ones. Everybody else we consider an ally, but we keep them at arm's distance because, like we've discussed before, intelligence and technology is much more valuable if it's stolen than to do the research, development, technology, and evaluation of whatever widget it is, whether it's a computer, whether it's a missile, whether it's a bomb, it doesn't matter. It's much easier to steal it, and that's what most of our adversaries are doing through cyber attacks.
Is Russia a special case at this juncture?
We have analysts that...
To the extent that the media portrays it. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have seemed to forgot China, they're focused on Russia. Is that kind of a misleading reorientation of the media?
I would say yes, in the sense that I think we've given President Vladimir Putin kind of a persona as this demagogue, and the Russian intelligence service obviously has always been very powerful, but really China is our main adversary.
Okay.
They have a systemic approach to acquire our technology and our financial information and our intellectual property on a systemic basis. There's no denying that whatsoever.
And I think in this business that you were in, you have the situation where Chinese nationals can come in, they can get jobs, they might not be themselves working on an espionage project, but they would have contact with other governments. So there's a kind of a leaking that can go on you have to be aware of and kind of understand the relationships that go on. Am I phrasing that correctly?
I don't think that China would leak anything. They have a very robust program to acquire our military information, our military technologies, cutting-edge technologies, and older technologies. There's a systemic approach. Thousands of Chinese students are allowed in this country every year to work, really, on some of our most sensitive projects.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that China would leaking to us. I mean, they would acquire information and leak it to other parties out there. And speaking of China, they recently seized an unmanned underwater vehicle, and that kind of came and went without a huge comment. If Russia or Iran had done that, the press would have presumably gone into meltdown, I think it's fair to say. China did it. However, the U.S. press focused on a misspelled tweet from Trump when he made a comment about it. Your thoughts on that?
In my business, when the Chinese did that in international waters, essentially stealing one of our technologies, it's just a criminal act, almost an act of war. Even though people are saying, well, they're giving it back, obviously they took the product, they took the drone, they would assume reverse engineer it, took a very good look at it, and probably gave it back to us in a box. Why that has not been given more press and there's more outrage on the American public side is probably because the current administration probably wants it to be glossed over as well. I don't think you'd have the same reaction with the Trump administration, knowing that a lot of his new cabinet members are former Marines and generals who probably would not look at that as the same way as the current administration looks at it.
All right, let me get your thoughts on this topic of terrorism. And obviously it's a number one kind of priority, I think, for world governments. And it seemingly the two actors that would have the greatest ability to work together and fight terrorism, there's a couple of choices. One, a country like the U.S. would have to partner with somebody. So let me ask you this. I'll give you a couple of choices. You tell me which one is the best partner to have. U.S. and Britain, U.S. and Israel, U.S. and Russia, or U.S. and Australia? Of those four choices, what combination would form the absolute most potent force to fight terrorism?
That's a very difficult question because it's all apples and oranges. You have some countries who have very good technological technologies in terms of eavesdropping, satellite usage, that type of thing. Then you have a country such as Israel, which has very good human penetration operations that, because they've been in a constant war for about 25 years with some of their Middle Eastern neighbors, have more of a ground approach to it. So it's very difficult to say I would choose one or the other, or one is better than the other. That's why we do everything in really in a joint environment. And many times when I spent time in Afghanistan for the last 5 years, you see a joint environment is the best environment. Not to say that this partner is better or this partner is not as good or brings more to the table. Everyone brings something to the table, and that's why you see so many coalition-type forces being formed, especially the last 15 years.
All right, so now let's get into a really kind of a hot topic, I think, from the guys that work in intelligence, and that would be the issue of Hillary's server. We have heard from her camp that, you know, she's been downplaying the whole thing the whole time, the leaked emails from her server. What's your perspective on that?
I was in total disbelief, essentially, when that story actually broke, that her server was, that she was using a private server, that it was actually located in her bathroom or somewhere in her house in Chappaqua, New York. Having been trained in handling classified and knowing the levels of classification that she probably handled, which was the top, let me back up a minute, and just make an abject statement that it not only was pure malfeasance on her part, but obviously a criminal act. There's just no way around it, because having been raised with handling classified my whole life, or at least 26 years of my life, you know, people have been fired for leaving documents, you know, in on their office desk and not put it back in their safe in a secure compartmented facility. People have been, you know, fired for leaving classified in hotel rooms or giving it to the wrong person.
She claims she didn't know what the word C, the letter C meant.
Yeah, it's just, it actually borders on, I don't know how else to say it. It's just absurd.
Am I correct in that saying that when she's on her BlackBerry, at some point she's actually reviewing this information? How does that work exactly? Can you describe that?
I probably would not ever know the levels of what she receives or what she reads, but having known that as a Secretary of State of the United States of America, she's probably the top two or three people in the world that are being targeted by foreign intelligence services. There is no question that every foreign intelligence service is interested in what the Secretary of State of the United States wants and what is her or his intentions for this country, that country, or for our country. So essentially, when you say that her server was in her bathroom, there was a total disregard for any of the things that we ever were taught. And for it to be at the top level like that is beyond belief in my
And the processing of this information, as I'm not an expert of, but my understanding is that there's a way to sanitize sensitive information.
Sure. I mean, when you're an operative in the field or you're an agent in the field and you write a report, which is X amount of pages, 5, 10, 15 pages, as it goes up the chain to your supervisor and your headquarters and to people at the secretary level or at the presidential level, it obviously gets into a usable format. But to say that she never received classified information on her BlackBerry or on her server is virtually impossible. We already know she received a few hundred documents.
Does this preclude her from FOIA requests?
It does, because she's mixing her personal with a professional life. So when you send something to a Hillary Clinton email and not a .state.gov or a federal email system, obviously there's no more retention. And yes, people like yourself who are journalists cannot FOIA something that's on a personal server. But it looks like...
And that could have been by intention.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's a criminal offense.
But I think the bigger issue here is that this was all at the top levels. And I think we've kind of touched on this before, where it wasn't Hillary Clinton. I'm not defending Hillary Clinton in any way, shape, or form. But obviously all of her staff and other people in the State Department, and even President Obama himself, who used a pseudonym to contact her because he knew he was contacting her private server, is just incredible to me.
All right, Ed, we got to cut it off there. Thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Ed Z.
Greetings. Let me welcome you to my health and wellness seminar on tape. My name is Fereydoon Batman Gelic. I'm a doctor of medicine. I was born in 1931 in Tehran, Iran. I received my secondary school education in Scotland and then in England, and I went to medical school at St. Mary's Hospital of London University. When I completed my training as a doctor, I went back to Iran. I was practicing medicine for a while, and then I started getting engaged in construction of hospitals, medical schools, and so on. When the revolution came and the revolutionary mullahs wanted to take over the country, they also wanted to take over all projects and confiscate assets and so on, because they had people around them who needed new jobs and opportunities. So a lot of people who were already working were displaced, put in prison, and some of them shot in order to confiscate their assets. I was one of them. I was put into prison in November 1979, and with the possibility of being shot. In the prison, in that stressful environment where thousands of people were put in order to be stripped of their position in the society and their assets confiscated, and it was very stressful, I made a discovery that the human body has got many sophisticated indicators when it's dehydrated, and stress is a situation where the body becomes dehydrated from inside. Dehydration produces a variety of symptoms and signs that we in the medical profession have not understood and have treated as indicators of diseases. So it was, in a way, a blessing to me that I was put into prison and I discovered this fundamental understanding of the human body. And I would like to share this with you so that you understand what happens to the body when we don't drink enough water, or what happens to the body when it's dehydrated and how it reveals its dehydration. Because traditionally, we have understood that when the mouth is dry, then the body is short of water, the body is thirsty. Based on this false assumption, we've assumed that all the other varieties of conditions produced by dehydration are signs of diseases, not knowing that the human body has got a number of sophisticated indicators when it runs short of water. The first time I discovered this was when, late one night, early when I had entered the prison, two other prisoners brought a third person who was doubled up to my cell block in the room where 18 of us were sleeping. And I was woken up, asked to treat a fellow prisoner who had peptic ulcer disease, and I had no medication to give him. I was a prisoner myself. Everything I had was taken away. All I possessed were the clothes that I wore. The man was doubled up, couldn't stand straight. These two other persons had to support him. He told me he was an old peptic ulcer disease sufferer. He had had a lot of pain all day, and late at night, when the pain became so severe that he couldn't stand it anymore, he wanted to go to the doctors at the prison dispensary, but the guards wouldn't take him. So he came to me thinking that I would have some medication to give him, and I had none. I told him that I know that water will cure his problem or relieve his pain, and I gave him two glasses of water, which he drank, two glasses of 300 cc's, to get altogether about a pint of water. And within 8 minutes, his pain disappeared. He asked me, what should I do if the pain comes back. I told him to drink more water, and then I thought I better give him a professional instruction. I told him to drink 2 glasses of water every 3 hours when he's awake. 3 days later, he came to me and he said, ever since that night, he hasn't had any more pain, and what should he do now? I told him, well, continue for another 6 weeks. This man was in the same block with me for the next 4 months, and he was completely pain-free in that prison environment where stress was causing so many health problems, from anxiety, from not knowing what happened to the family, because once they're in prison, their family is not safe either. But in that stressful environment, water proved to be a most effective medication against peptic ulcer disease pain, because this man's peptic ulcer was a recognized one. He had many bouts of bleeding before. He obviously had been suffering for a number of years from this problem. When in that stressful environment, water relieved his pain completely, and he became independent of any medication, it proved that water had certain qualities that we in the medical profession did not understand. So for the duration of 2 years and 7 months that I was in prison, I treated many, many conditions that are stress-induced with water, and I discovered tremendous results. The highlight of this research of mine in the prison was such that I treated over 3,000 peptic ulcer disease sufferers, the ones who had the severe pain and needed medication in order to relieve it. Because after all, when we call a disease a peptic ulcer disease, it's not the ulceration itself that takes the patient to the doctor. It is the pain of ulcer, or the pain that takes the person to the doctor. Not all people who have the pain have the ulcer, but all the people who have the ulcer have the pain. When over 3,000 persons who had the label of peptic ulcer disease or the symptoms and signs of peptic ulcer disease got relief from water, obviously there was a mistake somewhere, and we needed to have a new understanding of the role of water in the human body and the cause of the body for water, because obviously these people were thirsty and they did not have a disease. Now, in order to get into the meat of this discussion, I will read you a few letters, and then I will give you my explanation of why water produced this relief. This is from a lady, Marjorie Ramsey, written to me November 22, 1993. I have just ordered another copy of your book on water, having given a son my first copy. I tell everybody about it and my experiences. Perhaps you would be interested. My first son, Charles, 58, who lives with me, is deaf and autistic. I take him 3 or 4 days a week to a facility for the handicapped. They had been taking his blood pressure there and notified me that the doctor said he should go on medication. His BP was 160 over 100 to 104. I had just received your book and asked the MD to let me experiment for 2 weeks. Reluctantly, he agreed, but warned me it was very dangerous. I kept Charles home and used the water routine, also adding a little magnesium and potassium. 2 weeks later, the nurse took his BP, and it was 106 over 80. She said the doctor will be in shortly. Evidently, the MD didn't believe her, and he checked it himself, and had to admit it was so. He didn't ask me what I did, so I did not tell him about water. But if the BP continues as it is, I will tell him. I went on the water routine too, without any particular problem in mind, but noticed that in about 10 days, my tendency to get dizzy if I moved my head quickly had disappeared. I also had been unable to lower my head to lie flat at night and had to have several pillows. Now I am much better and have had only one spell in over a month. I am 82 and a half years. This is an update. Now, she has written to me on the 3rd of July, about a year and 10 months later. I was so pleased that you found my letter useful for your new edition, which I found very impressive. Thank you. As you know, I mentioned that by following your water routine, I immediately noticed an improvement in my vertigo problem. Here is an update. Besides sleeping with one pillow instead of four, I can shampoo in a wash bowl without getting dizzy. I can lie on a slant board, which elevates my feet 18 inches. I don't have to worry about turning my head quickly when driving. While vertigo was not a constant problem, it had been with me from time to time for at least 40 years. But that is history now. Some other benefits. I seldom have leg cramps now, which bothered me almost nightly. And more good news. Most of my upper teeth are capped, and over the years had developed unsightly gaps as the gums receded. Suddenly I realized that the gaps were gone and the gums looked as good as originally. What a happy surprise. That certainly emphasizes how the body tissues can dry out and shrink. For an 84-year-old, I am in very good health, and in some ways better than 10 years ago. Charles, who is deaf and autistic, is doing well. He has gained weight, which he needed, and looks healthier and behaves better than at any time since he was a toddler. I don't know whether I'm imagining it or not, but it seems to me he is responding to sounds lately. I tell others about drinking water whenever I can. Thank you for your contribution and your courage and persistence in working for the acceptance of this information. I have seen references to your book in several health publications. The letter from Marjorie Ramsey, I will discuss later. It reveals a lot of issues that we need to address as an understanding of chronic dehydration in the human body. For 40 years, she had the problem of vertigo, and no one thought that she would probably be dehydrated. This is another letter from Mrs. Loretta M. Johnson. In May 11th, 1994, Mrs. Loretta Johnson wrote to me, "Dear Dr. Batman-Gelidge, I am 90 years old. I have angina. I do not get chest pains or cramps, but at the base of my throat, I get an ache, a painful tension, and my pulse beats like a runaway horse. But after I read your book, Your Body's Many Cries for Water, I started drinking water. When I get an attack of angina, I rest and drink water. Would you believe it? I don't need the nitrostat, buffered nitroglycerin, anymore. I am so glad because the nitro burned my mouth and gave me oral ulcers. Now I carry a small bottle of water with me at all times, in addition to drinking it at home. Thanks a million." You see, this is a 90-year-old lady whose discomfort of dehydration was reflected at the back of her throat and diagnosed as angina. So you see, chronic dehydration can reflect itself in various forms. We in the medical profession have label these states of dehydration and the complications associated with dehydration, the pathology that's produced by dehydration, the damage that's caused by dehydration, and label them as disease conditions. And the pharmaceutical industry very appropriately has produced a number of medications and chemicals to silence the signal systems of the body for dehydration. We've gone along with the pharmaceutical industry and used the medications on a temporary basis, thinking that we are curing the disease or the body will cure itself, and not knowing that the medications that silence dehydration or the signal systems of dehydration will only cause more damage because dehydration is not gone away. That dehydration will produce damage, except that it's not doing it in a silent way. In order to be able to understand dehydration, we need to go back and do a shift of attention, because the medical profession has not understood, we have not understood, scientists have not understood, and they've assumed all along that dehydration doesn't exist because water is abundant, people have access to water, they don't have to pay money for it, and the body understands when it's short of water, and the body will drink, or the person will drink. Further damage is caused because in place of water, now society has learned that colored water or laced water in form of coffee, tea, alcoholic beverages, and sodas, just because they contain water, will replace the water needs of the body. So commercialization of these beverages has caused further damage because what these beverages contain produce further complications in the body because all of them are dehydrating beverages. The medical profession has not given clear direction to the public by stating, well, you must drink water. They think that any fluids will do, and people by and large will quench their thirst. So they have paid attention mainly to the solid composition of the body and not the water content of the body. And the idea of dehydration doing damage as a very slowly establishing process has not entered the realm of research. Even though there is plenty of water around, the cells of the body could still become dehydrated is something that has got to be understood, because that is exactly what happens to the body as a result of not drinking water. Everyone knows water is essential for the body. Everyone knows that without water they cannot survive. But no one knows what happens to the body if you don't give it adequate water. We in the medical profession never understood it, and that is why so many labels of diseases have crept up, and there are so many syndromes, there are so many conditions. There are so many conditions that have been labeled as diseases, whereas at the root of the problem, chronic dehydration has been the cause, and complications of dehydration have been labeled as the disease process. Before I get into explanations of dehydration, let me read you another letter from Sam Liguori. Sam Liguori is a radio talk show host in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He's in his late 40s or very early 50s. He writes, "Dear Dr. Batman-Gilich, just a short letter to thank you for informing our listeners about the health benefits of drinking 2 quarts of water a day. Not only did you help our radio audience, but I personally have enjoyed the resurgence of energy after drinking 2 quarts of water each day for just over 1 week. The angina pain I endured for 5 years has disappeared, and my distress from a hiatal hernia has greatly lessened. I feel like a new man. I have been doing a talk show at World Radio for the past 20 years, and I must say, your interview with us is one I will always remember. Sincerely, Sam Liguori, World Broadcasting Corporation Program Director." So Sam, also a younger person, had angina, and his pain disappeared by drinking water. We now have 2 persons with angina whose pains disappeared. Obviously, these people were thirsty. They didn't know it. Obviously, they didn't know that the fluids they were drinking wasn't the water that the body needed. And that's why they had the pain. Now, in order to get into the detail of how chronic dehydration establishes in the body and what are its indicators, we must understand, first and foremost, how we developed from water, and water has given life to us, how we depend on water as a life-giving substance on a continuous basis. In order to understand that, we must go back. We know that the human body and the animal species that came out of water have much similarity of design. Whether we believe in continuity of design development from one species to another in the form of evolution, or whether the Creator created on the basis of development of other species, species man, it is immaterial because the foundation of design is the same. They're all water dependent. For the sake of argument, we will stick to the evolution because we can explain the situation much better. Original species that stepped on land went from salt water of the sea to fresh water and then came to land. Now, we know that original DNA was created in water by high voltage of lightning, or at least this is the assumption, and this DNA gradually developed further and further until the first single cell species was created, from which other cells were formed and other species developed and eventually came to create the various species in the animal kingdom. They all came out of water. Seawater was the original site of development, and it is understood that in order to come for better living quarters, for more food and better sunlight, they came into fresh water, lived in fresh water, developed amphibian capabilities of living in water and on land, and eventually settling down on land. In the amphibian species, before they developed water regulatory mechanism, they had to go back into water every few minutes, and then eventually every few hours, and then eventually every few days, in order to not dry up. In this process of development, which must have taken at least a million or a few million years, the species developed a water regulatory mechanism. When they were on land and they were not, they didn't have access to water, they developed a mechanism of water preservation. Therefore, reliance on fresh water, which was available to them in the rivers and lakes, had to gradually be trimmed or molded to the development of the species on land. Each cell in the body of a multi-cell individual or animal species is still bathed in salt water. It has brought its salty environment of the sea with it in the capsule of the body that is now land-based. So in other words, we, human beings, are land-based satellites of the original water-dwelling species. We still depend on water on a regular basis not to dry up. In the same way as the amphibian species, from which it is said man developed, were always anxious not to dry up, we have developed the same anxiety for our body when it is short of water. We understand that. Because before coming to live on land, the body developed a freshwater regulatory mechanism. It developed its thirst instincts for water. Now, 100 years ago, when we were doing research, or scientists were doing research on the water regulatory systems, doctor called Walter Bradford Cannon, who was an eminent English physician of the time, forced his will on the rest of the community of professionals and said, dry mouth is the only sign of dehydration for the human body. He did not explain how he came to this conclusion, but since he had established a political clout at the time and people wanted to accommodate this gentleman, so they adopted this mistaken assumption that dry mouth is the only sign of dehydration in the body, because a person who has got a dry mouth will obviously go and drink. Well, that is not so. However, the body that becomes dehydrated has got a mechanism of water preservation and water distribution, because the brain cell is 85% water. The rest of the cells of the body are 75% water. Brain cells take absolute priority over the rest of the body for their water needs. And that is why, of all the circulation that goes around in the body, 20% is allotted to the brain, which is only 1/50th of the total body weight. And therefore, the brain gets its priority ration. However, at the expense of the rest of the body, if there is dehydration. And it is this dehydration in the rest of the body that the brain tries to correct, because it understands that the rest of the body is dehydrated, and that's why brain gets ration of water more than anywhere else, in order to be able to regulate all the functions that are dependent on the intake of water and food. Everyone knows that water is essential for the body, as I explained, but not many people know why. Let me explain to you. Water is essential for metabolism. What happens is when you eat food, unless water is available, you cannot digest the food. The food that you eat will have to be broken down, and in order to break the food particles into elements that can be used, water is essential because it has a, what they call, hydrolytic property. It breaks down products under enzyme stimulus. Water is used in order to break down the food particles. Imagine a tree being cut down by a handsaw. In order to be able to move the handsaw, you need a wedge so that the cut ends don't sink onto the saw. Exactly what happens in the metabolism of food when two particles are being separated, which were joined together to form a solid mass of food. Water is used in between those particles in order to break them up. Water breaks itself and it gives its energy to the food particle, and it is that hydrolyzed, in other words, broken down, prepared food particle that the body taps into for its energy value. One of the properties of water is property of hydrolysis, which means breakdown of food particles because of the action of water and the energy transfer from water to the particle.
The seminar is continued on side two.
It is absolutely essential to have water in order to be able to metabolize food and break it down to its various components that are required by the body. In the body also, all the functions that depend on metabolism depend on water in order to be able to conduct the various chemical reactions that constitute the metabolism of the person. That's one property of water in the body, in any living body. The other property of water is that it rushes through cell membrane, turns certain hydroelectric type pumps. They call them cation pumps. They call them sodium potassium pumps. Some of these cation pumps that are turned by water produce voltage, and this voltage is stored in certain batteries called ATP energy sources, just like coal and coke dumps that are used outside fossil fuel fired electrical plants that generate electricity and distribute it to the city, except that in the cells of the body, these are tiny, tiny generators, like generators that you have for a single house. There are hundreds, thousands, millions of these generators at the cell membrane, depending on where they are located and what is the type of the cell. And water, by going through these generators or turning these generators, produces energy. And the energy that's stored in ATP and GTP stockpiles of energy that the cells begin to use as and if they need the energy dispensation. ATP and GTP are chemical sources of energy in the body, and water helps generate these stockpiles. It is the hydroelectric energy that's stored in these stockpiles that constitute the bulk of the energy used by the body. The food that we eat is not the main source of energy for the body. It is hydroelectric energy that is used in the main for many, many, many of the functions of the cells of the body, particularly at the brain level. And that's why the brain has 85% of its volume in water, because it is this water that rushes into the cell and generates energy. Another function of this water is that it has certain qualities that, like ice that sticks to the finger, at a certain structure and form becomes adhesive material that sticks, bonds the solid structure of the membrane together. In other words, water is the bonding material at the cell membrane. So the importance of water, without any doubt, now recognized, except that it hasn't crept into the understanding of practice of medicine. So there are three functions in the main that we should understand depend on water: hydroelectric energy, breakdown of food particles and transfer of its energy to the particle, and also as the adhesive, as the bonding material for the cell architecture. In the same way as we build a house and we use bricks and mortar in order to develop a house, the cells of the body use water as the adhesive material in place of mortar and stick the hydrocarbon brick structures together in order to create a membrane around the cell. So water is absolutely essential in order to keep the cell intact. Water has this stickiness of ice at higher body temperature because it develops that form inside the body at the cell membrane that the ice forms outside in the environment under cold temperature. Another main function of water is that in the brain in particular, the brain cells and the nerves that go from brain cells to their destination from head to foot, to put it mildly, all the transport systems, the fast transport system in the brain tissue is carried through waterways on monorails. The monorails are called microtubes. They are like drainage pipes that are laid in bogland, and water is drained from the vicinity. An area of loose water is created, in other words, area of less viscous, more fluid environment around this monorail or microtube on which most of the manufactured materials are transported in form of sacks and vesicles that contain the essential elements or transmitter material that are carried from one destination to another. Therefore, most of the transports in the brain tissue is based on a float mechanism that is directed by its attachment to the monorail guidelines and transported to the destination. Therefore, water for the function of the nerve is absolutely essential. Not only will it provide the energy, it will also become the material that bonds the nerve cells together and the membrane of the nerve cells. And also on waterways inside the cell, we have transport system dependent on the flow of water. Now, imagine if you lived under the ocean and you had to have a mechanism of transport, this would be an ideal way. Create a guide rope and attach anything that you wanted to transport from one location to another and put it on a forward drive and let it go to its destination depending where the tube takes it or the monorail takes it or the rope takes it. This is how transport system in the brain from one location to another is carried out on waterways, what they call low viscosity areas. So water now develops an infinitely greater importance in your mind as far as your brain function is concerned. And that's why the brain gets 20% of its circulation of the body, because any water that's available in the bloodstream must be made available to the brain so that the brain can function and regulate the functions of the rest of the body. Another function of water is that proteins and enzymes of the body function much better in an environment where there is plenty of water. In other words, environment where there is less viscosity, less stickiness, there is more fluidity, there is more water available. Just like a swimming pool that is full of kids, a person who wants to swim and swim, a lap swimmer wants to get some exercise or practice, will not be able to swim well in a pool full of kids. The enzymes of the body are just like that. They function much better in solutions of less viscosity. Imagine each enzyme is a lap swimmer. It has to swim to its destination in order to function. This is the reason why it is a fallacy to say that don't drink water in order to dilute your enzymes or juices in the stomach. It's wrong. Food digestion is much more efficient when there is plenty of water inside the stomach. We'll get into this later. And that's why a lot of people who have indigestion, they have a lot of gas, they are not digesting their food because there is not enough water. So basically there are five most important functions of the body that depend on the ample presence of water in the body. And that's why chronic dehydration should be assumed to be a damaging state to the body, and why it is important to recognize the newly understood thirst signals of the human body. We now agree that the human body is water dependent. It's a satellite species or satellite station of water-dwelling species on land. And in order to survive on land, it has developed a water regulatory mechanism that is based on drought management. we now understand that the human body desperately needs water on a constant basis, because dehydration would produce much damage in the body. In order to understand the role of water, we must understand the development of the person, which is water dependent. Each soft tissue cell of the body is 75% water, the brain is 85% water. Therefore, in the process of growth of a child inside, or the fetus inside the uterus of the mother, in order that one cell would break up and make two cells, and two would make four, and four would make eight, and eventually 9 months later would develop a child that could survive outside the uterus, those cells needed much water in order to produce the human being of the future. And the mother had to provide the water
through her uterine wall.
Through the vascular system of the mother, the child or the fetus would draw water. The mechanisms of drawing water from the mother are complicated, but let us generalize it by saying that there is a mechanism involved that employs some neurotransmitters, some chemical agents that stimulate various functions to bring water into the vicinity of the living cell inside the uterus, the child that is to be. These hormones, or these transmitters, or these chemical agents should be assumed to be growth-promoting substances. Therefore, a growth hormone is involved, and also a water regulatory substance or transmitter, neurotransmitter, that's employed in the nerve tissue contact points, which mistakenly has been assumed to be a nuisance substance up to now, and that is histamine. Histamine is a neurotransmitter and the main water regulator of the body. Histamine is with us from hour one of life, or even earlier, because when a single cell fertilized egg of the mother by the sperm of the father is still one cell, and before it divides to make up two daughter cells, it has the ability to command histamine action. Histamine is available to that cell and produces the desired mechanisms involved in order to bring water to the area. Therefore, two substances, growth hormone and histamine, are the two factors or two elements that regulate functions in the development of a child or a fetus from its hour one of life until it comes out of the uterus after 9 months. Still in its process of growth from day one of life on land, outside its watery environment of the uterus, the fetus or the child has now developed a skin structure, a capsule that can survive outside the environment, within, outside, in the air, on land. In its process of growth until the age of 18, when the length of the body is determined, still growth hormone and histamine regulate all functions pertinent to growth development, and that involves intake of at least 75% of water to be put into each cell, soft tissue cell. Also the bone structures, but at a less level of its water content. By the age of 18, when the bones have fixed, they are not growing in length, and the person is not growing any taller, gradually growth hormone
stops, growth hormone secretion is lessened. However, it still continues to be present until the age of 25 when full width of the body is developed. From there on, there is still growth hormone, but not so much as before. However, histamine is there, present as the main water regulator of the body, because it's a transmitter that regulates the functions inside the cell. It is dependent on the normal function of the cation pump. When cation pump or the sodium-potassium pump is not functioning, it means that water is not available in order to energize the pump. And therefore, histamine becomes active and turns the pump by releasing energy for the function of the pump. It taps into the stored energy of the body, releases it for the function of the pump, because that pump, other than generating electricity, is also the regulator of the osmotic balance, the concentration balance between inside the cell and outside the cell. From the age of 25 onwards, therefore, it is histamine that is the main water regulator of the body. The less water that is available to the body, the more histamine becomes engaged in water management. It's the main drought manager of the body. It compels a person to drink, creates a rationing system within the body. It regulates the pumps or the valves in the arteries and the pillaries of the body to produce the shunting that is required in order to reroute circulation to bring water to the area that is needed most. And it is the function of histamine and its subordinate regulators, which are called vasopressin. It's another one of the transmitter systems. Renin-angiotensin, another system in the rationing of water, where it produces the constriction in the arterioles, and prostaglandins, which are the main cellular water regulators, and kinins that are sensitive to the salt balance of the body, because salt is essential in order to maintain the water outside the cell. Let me explain. There are basically two oceans of water in the body. There is the ocean of water that's inside the cells of the body, the sum total of that volume of water which is inside the cells. Then there is the ocean of water outside the cells. Now, water that we drink regulates the ocean inside the cells. The salt that we take regulates the ocean outside the cells. It's osmotic balance between the inside of the cell and outside of the cell depends on the intake of both water and salt. In other words, taking water by itself and not taking salt will establish enough water inside the cell, but the outside of the cell will not have enough water, and therefore the body, in order to maintain this balance, will reject some of the water that's inside the cells. So lack of salt in the body can also produce dehydration inside the cells, because there is a mechanism of rejecting water that is not osmotically balanced. Now, kinins are sensitive to the salt level of the body. Histamine is sensitive to the water level of the body. And between them, they regulate the two oceans. It is a most important finding to recognize that these oceans must be balanced, and the two elements that regulate these are histamine and kinins. These are the ration masters of the body. Histamine is the main ration master for water, and kinin-operated systems are the main mechanism for balancing the salt intake of the body, salt appetite at the mouth level. The cravings that we have are dependent on regulation of kinin for the salt intake of the body. Now, these are the regulators of water in the body, the water content of the body, the full volume of the body, and they also produce the signal systems that are now recognized to be signs of dehydration, because when histamine becomes active, excessively active, it means that water is short. When kinins become excessively active, it means that salt is short in the body. And between them, there is a relationship that histamine and kinins, they stimulate each other's activity. And therefore, they're an integrated system in order to maintain the two oceans of the body in balance. We need to understand that. These regulators of water intake and salt intake are also the producers of the emergency calls of the body for water. And I say for water because even if we are salt deficient, that salt deficiency translates to water deficiency in the body, albeit at the outside the cell environment, the ocean outside the cell. Therefore, in order to understand dehydration, we must understand the role of water and the role of salt in the body. Now, water turns the cation pumps, and one of the elements that is essential in order to for the pump to turn is the presence of salt. So these two elements are essential for generation of energy at the cell membrane. The other element that's essential is potassium. These two, potassium and sodium, are the two ends of a swing that water turns as if this swing is a generator, a dynamo, and produces energy at the cell membrane. The functional body is about energy. That's why it came on land. The species that came on land came in quest of energy. They retained their hydroelectric mechanism, but they came on land for the other requirements, the protein balances and so on that the body needs in order to develop into a larger mass. We understand the role of food for development of growth. However, we did not understand the role of water in this equation, and we did not understand that dehydration could be the limiting factor in the development of a normal structure. And that is why dehydration is a disease-producing state in the body. Initially, it starts with a dis-ease, in other words, discomfort, pain, and so on, and then eventually develops into pathology, damage, that we recognize as this or that disease. Having explained so far the role of water, how do we get dehydrated? Let me explain that. Perception. As we grow older, because we are relying on the rationing system of the body for water, because we are relying on drought management mechanisms in the body, we gradually lose our thirst perception. When we give one glass of water to the body and it needs two, the body has to manage the water that's come in according to a priority mechanism. Therefore, some parts of the body go dehydrated, and we don't understand this. The brain regulates the mechanisms involved with the amount of water that is available. And as we grow older, we lose our perception of thirst. we don't recognize thirst because we have shortchanged the body constantly. We've given it wrong information. We've said there isn't enough water around. And therefore, it doesn't receive the amount of water that it requires. From the age of 20 to old age, we shortchange the body gradually until the two pools or the two oceans in the body reverse their size, whereas the ocean of water inside the cells of the body contained infinitely more water than the ocean of the water outside the cells. By the age of 80, that ratio is reversed. The cells are now dehydrated, and the vascular system is not reflecting that dehydration. Because if we shortchange the body with the water that it requires, 66% of that loss is borne by the cells. In other words, the cells become 66% dehydrated as compared with the extracellular fluid, which is only 26% dehydrated. And the vascular system lose 8%. To explain it further, when we lack water, 66% of that deficiency is reflected in the cells, 26% is reflected outside the cell volume of serum and fluids, and only 8% is reflected in the vascular bed. And since the vascular bed is designed in such a way that it tightens in order to accommodate that deficiency, we do not recognize it. We do not recognize dehydration by the tests that we do, except that some cells, the red cells, become a little more shrunken. However, this has not become an issue in medicine, that chronic dehydration can settle inside the cells of the body.
You now have a bird's eye view of dehydration, the tip of the iceberg. You need to listen to the other tapes in their order to get more detailed and connected information on how different dehydration-produced diseases occur. In some of the tapes, I have taken the liberty of repeating explanation of some of the vital functions of the body that depend on water. I repeated myself as a way of stressing the importance of the information. Don't imagine that I repeated it because I didn't have more material to tell you, but I repeated the information so that you understand it fully, because those pieces of information are vital to the understanding of the functions of the cell.